This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Our next guest has a modest goal. He wants to upend just about everything we think we know about the nature of facts. And to understand his work better, Samuel Arbesman suggested we take another look at the popular movie Men in Black, specifically the scene where Will Smith first lays eyes on the aliens who've come to planet Earth. Then Tommy Lee Jones tells him this.
1,500 years ago, everybody knew the Earth was the center of the universe. 500 years ago, everybody knew the Earth was flat. And 15 minutes ago, you knew that people were alone on this planet.
Imagine what you'll know tomorrow.
Far out. The thing is, we can't imagine what we'll know tomorrow because facts are constantly shifting. And it seems as if they're changing faster than ever, which makes a lot of people feel pretty uncomfortable and uncertain. But Samuel Arbesman says, don't panic. There is an actual pattern, a predictable rhythm to how facts change. Now think about it. It is an amazing assertion. A predictable rhythm to how facts change? I can actually hardly imagine it, but it can help us make better sense of the world, and that is what Sam Arbesman says. He is a senior scholar at the Kauffman Foundation and a fellow at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University. He's written all about it in a new book called The Half-Life of Facts, Why Everything We Know Has an Expiration Date. Sam Arbesman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
It's really great to have you. The book is mind-bendingly cool, but let me ask you to start with a simple story that you start the book off with, and that is the fact that when your grandfather was in dental school in the late 1930s, he learned all about what was then known about the human genome, and he learned about how many chromosomes humans have, and how many did he learn then?
So when he was in school, he learned 48.
Which is
wrong.
wrong according to what we know now.
Yes. We now think it's 46. So it turns out, I believe in the 1920s, someone counted the number of chromosomes in every human cell. They all have the same number. And they got the number 48. And this number remained in the textbooks for several decades until the mid-1950s when a team of scientists decided to recount using a better scientific technique. And they found out that the number they thought was correct was wrong. It was off by two.
It was off by two. So it's like a simple shift in just a number. But what does this story tell you about the nature of how we understand what we think are irrefutable truths about the world?
Well, I think we all know intuitively that a large number of our facts are changing around us. So what's nutritious or not, how we think about dinosaurs. So I learned that dinosaurs looked like big green reptilian monsters, and we now think they look sort of like fearsome chickens with feathers, and they're fast moving and kind of smaller. So all these things are changing, and I think a lot of people know that some facts are changing, and it can be a little alarming. But the idea is that beneath all of this, beneath all the change, there's actually a regularity, and you can only see that when you look at all of what we know together. And then it turns out when you do that, there's an order to how knowledge grows, how it changes, and even how it becomes overturned over time.
Okay, so I want to get into this further, but why don't I have you do that by reading an excerpt of your book, The Half-Life of Facts. It's there on page 2, and it describes a little bit about how in this day and age we should be pretty used to thinking that everything we know we won't know pretty soon.
Sure. So, facts change all the time. Smoking has gone from doctor recommended to deadly. Meat used to be good for you, then bad to eat, then good again. Now it's a matter of opinion. The age at which women are told to get mammograms has increased. We used to think that the Earth was the center of the universe, and our planet has since been demoted. I have no idea any longer whether red wine is good for me. And to take a familial example, my father, a dermatologist, told me about a multiple-choice exam he took in medical school that included the same question 2 years in a row. The answer choices remained exactly the same, but 1 year the answer was one choice, and the next year it was a different one. Our world seems to be in constant flux. With our knowledge changing all the time, even the most informed people can barely keep up. All this change may seem random and overwhelming. Dinosaurs have feathers? When did that happen? But it turns out there is actually order within the shifting noise.
Sam Arbesman, that's from your book, The Half-Life of Facts. And when I read this all day today, I was practically, I felt like shouting from the top of my lungs, what? What? There's an order there's an understandable pattern in how facts get overturned in our understanding of the world. How is it possible that there's a pattern to the evolution of our knowledge?
So the one example, the way to think about this is to actually think about radioactive atoms. So when you have a single atom of a radioactive material, like uranium, for example, we know exactly how an atom of a radioactive material will decay when it breaks down, but we don't know when. That could happen the next fraction of a second, or we might have to wait millions and millions of years. But if you take a lot of atoms and put them together, if you have an entire chunk of uranium, for example, suddenly it actually becomes systematic and regular. And you can actually you can plot a curve of the decay over time, and you can actually encapsulate it even in a single number, the half-life, which tells you how long it takes for half of the atoms to break down and decay. And you don't know which atoms are going to be in that half, but you do know overall the decay in the uranium. And the same thing is true with facts. We can't predict which specific discovery is going to occur or which fact is going to be overturned, but facts are actually quite far from random when viewed in the aggregate.
Okay, but this is what blows my mind, because the splitting of an atom is a physical process, right? I mean, it is something that can be observed of their actual atoms, you know, being cut apart. Facts are not physical things. How is it that we can measure that there's a half-life or a decay to the truthiness, if I can use that phrase, of what we know?
Well, certainly what we know is a little bit more messy than the world of physics. But about 10 years ago, a team of scientists in France actually set out to measure this. They wanted to see how long it takes for knowledge in different fields to become overturned. And so they used their own fields of expertise from medicine, in this case, hepatitis and cirrhosis, which are both related to diseases of the liver. And they gave a whole set of papers to a panel of experts from a span of 50 years. And they said, which of these papers are still true and which ones have been overturned or otherwise rendered obsolete? And then when they put them all together and they graphed it, they actually found a clear decay. And if you look at the graph of what they found, you can read off the graph directly how long it takes for half of these papers to become overturned. And in the case of these fields, they found it was about 45 years. So it took in these fields 45 years for half of the knowledge to become overturned.
And that's a regular pattern in those fields?
It seems to be pretty regular. I mean, look, if you look at the graph, I mean, it might not be one of these exponential decays similar to radioactive materials, but it seems pretty nice. Maybe it's speeding up, maybe it's slowing down. And of course, if you look at other fields, you can do similar analyses or you can use different ones. So a lot of people actually look at how long it takes for papers to stop receiving citations, so references elsewhere in the scientific literature, because when a paper is not receiving citations, it means it's essentially obsolete or no longer part of the current scientific conversation. And using that, a lot of people have been able to calculate the half-lives of different fields and see how fields, which fields are moving more quickly than others.
And so, I mean, you write in your book that things like physics, like facts or what are considered core truths in physics, last a lot longer than in biology.
Yeah, and of course it depends. Like, are you looking at articles? Are you looking at textbooks? But in physics, I mean, if I jot down an equation to describe the curve when you throw a baseball, that equation is not gonna change very much. While in biology, or certainly within the social sciences, where we're dealing with people and things are a lot messier and more, there's a lot more statistical noise. These kinds of things take time to sort out, and so it's not always certain that the results are going to stand the test of time. But the idea, that being said, as time passes, we are getting closer and closer to an understanding of how the world works. We're not just replacing what we knew with something else entirely different. It's part of getting closer and closer to an understanding. So just like how when Newton's theory of gravity was replaced by the Einsteinian theory of gravitation, it doesn't mean that everything Newton wrote was wrong. It was part of this approximation to the truth.
Mm. I'm speaking with Samuel Arbisman. He is a senior scholar at the Kauffman Foundation and a fellow at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard. He's author of the new book, The Half-Life of Facts, Why Everything We Know Has an Expiration Date. So, listeners, are you in one of these fields where you just presume that what you're studying now or what you know now is going to be obsolete 45, 40, 20, 10 years from now, even obsolete tomorrow? And if so, how has that changed your understanding of what you do and the world we live in? And when you hear Samuel Arbisman say, hey, don't panic, it's not random how knowledge and facts change, does that make you feel better or worse about the speed of knowledge and development in the modern age? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sam Arbisman, in the book, you say something which has stuck with me all day long. You write that knowing how facts change, how knowledge spreads, and how we adapt to new ideas are all important for a major reason, and that knowing how knowledge works can help us make sense of the world. So when I hear you say that there's a predictable cycle, a measurable cycle that mathematics can describe when it comes to how long it takes a fact to become obsolete, how does that help us make more sense of our world?
Well, I think it can allow us to see the order beneath all this flux and all the change that's happening. But it can also give us a better sense of how we should adapt to changing knowledge. So in the book, in addition to discussing how knowledge gets overturned, I also deal with how each of us deal with changing knowledge. So for example, just because some scientist learns something new doesn't mean that all of us instantly have that new bit of information, for example. It takes time to spread outwards. And even so, sometimes we don't always respond to this new bit of information in the way we should, which is adapting to it. So for example, a professor of mine from grad school, he was once teaching a course and came in on Tuesday and gave his lecture on a scientific topic. On Wednesday, he read a paper that actually invalidated what he learned on Tuesday. And so on Thursday, he came in and said, "Everything I told you, it's wrong. But if that bothers you, get out of science." And a lot of people, though, I think maybe some scientists have assimilated this, and that this is part of the scientific process. We know what we know is currently in a draft form. But the rest of us, it's a little hard to actually internalize this message. And so I think we need to recognize that this is how we have to constantly revisit what we know. And if we don't, there can actually be quite profound consequences. So in the 1800s, there was a physician, Ignaz Semmelweis. He noticed that in a certain hospital where he was working, that certain women were dying soon after they gave birth. But he noticed that it was primarily with the women who the doctors who performed the births, they had right before that been performing autopsies, and they weren't cleaning themselves. So he recommended that they wash their hands. And everyone ignored him. And the reason they ignored him, even after he showed it worked, that it actually cut down on deaths, was because at that point, there was no germ theory of disease. The current theory of disease was known as the miasma theory, which is this idea that there were low-lying clouds of sickness. And so if this idea of washing your hands and cleaning yourself, if it couldn't be fit into their current worldview, there was no reason to actually say, this is something we should accept. And so I think if we constantly recognize that we need to revisit what we know and recognize that science and knowledge in general is always in this draft form. And we are getting better at understanding the world, but along the way, a lot of what we know is going to become overturned. Then we'll be better adapted to deal with the change around us.
I take your point about how this is so clearly applicable to the world of science. But, I mean, for people who, you know, are the ones who took that person's advice and got out of science or maybe were never in it, how does this apply to, you know, the rest of humanity? Because it seems like everything's changing, you know, even beyond science, rather quickly.
Certainly everything is changing very, very rapidly. And as our ability to digitize information and even have computationally aided discovery increases, we're just learning so many more things. And so whether it's about what we know, so in the world of science, or even just the state of the world. So for example, take the how many billions of people there are on the planet. So
7 billion.
School,
yeah.
7 billion. I learned 5 billion. But a lot of people, and we recognize that we should update this information, but not everyone does. And so oftentimes we have information about the world that we might have read in a newspaper or magazine years ago and then forgotten to update it. So a friend of mine who he was having dinner with, I think, a well-known hedge fund manager. And this hedge fund manager began a story by saying, as we all know, there are 4 billion people on the planet. And everyone was kind of shocked because this number was just so outdated. And the truth is probably a lot of us have this outdated information in our minds, and it can actually affect what we know and what we do. And so I think we need to constantly recognize that we need to be aware of the facts that are changing around us, because far from it being sometimes esoteric knowledge, it can affect what we do, how we think about the world, and even what we eat and drink.
I want to get into more detail about exactly that in just a moment, but we've got lots of people who want to join this conversation. I'm speaking with Sam Arbuthnot. He's author of The Half-Life of Facts and Why Everything We Know Has an Expiration Date. John is calling from Plymouth. You're on the air, John.
Hi, yeah, I wanted to make a comment about the field that I am in. I am a doctor of pharmacy student in my final year, and currently in the midst of constant research. And in our field, the thing that we deal with is expiring knowledge all the time. And they certainly have huge ramifications in terms of patient care and how certain things we held true for years and years in terms of treating patients for certain diseases, those can change overnight, and we can find very rapidly that certain drug regimens that we thought were effective are in essence hurting people. And so in the field that we operate in, we are constantly having to change our ideas of what is best for patients and what is best basically for the community as a whole.
John, let me ask you, you're getting your PhD in pharmacy. Do you think that the field of pharmacy has the tools or is training future pharmacists to cope with this constant change and overturning of knowledge as well as it can?
Yeah, I certainly do. I'm a student and currently am a student at Mass College of Pharmacy in Worcester, and they've prepared us very well to research drug information based on the absolute newest and most reliable guidelines and clinical trials that are coming out. And we're taught to use our own opinion and our own analytical abilities to change our own practice on an individual basis as to what we think is best for patients using the newest information that's out there.
John, thank you so much for your call. Sam Arbisman, John's comment leads me to another portion of your book, which I think is really important, and it's echoed in that part of the excerpt that I had you read, where you said that it turns out there is actually order within the shifting noise. And now we're living in an age where there's so much information, so much data. I mean, just walking around, being a person living in 2012, you're generating data by everything you look at and touch. But when it comes to facts and the development of new knowledge, how are we, isn't the core issue is that we're only as good as the questions we ask of this huge tsunami of data?
Exactly. And yeah, we're generating a huge amount of information, whether or not it's our cell phones just throwing off information or even our web browsing history. All these different things are just generating huge amounts of information. And we can learn a lot about how we think about the world and how we interact with others. And so there's a great deal of possibility in sort of this realm of big data. But at the same time, though, if it's not evenly distributed in terms of what data we have available, then we're not actually learning all that we can. And, of course, this is not a new problem. It goes to the heart of what we're capable of measuring truly allows us to actually learn. And if we can't measure something, then our knowledge is far more meager. And there are many, many examples of how we know things, and oftentimes there's a bias in what we know because we're only able to measure certain things, and what we can't measure, or we have more difficulty measuring, therefore we don't know as much about it.
And at the same time, when it comes to that bias, the data in and of itself doesn't really have any meaning. And we as cultures and people who are analyzing the data assign it meaning, right? So it's very dependent on who's asking the questions.
Right. I think scientists are pretty careful in saying we shouldn't necessarily generalize from one specific example. So if you take, for example, cell phone records and use it to derive some understanding of how people interact in terms of social networks, we're careful to ascribe that within phone interactions. But oftentimes it can become a proxy for interactions more generally. And we sometimes should at least be a little bit more hesitant in making that kind of generalization and that jump.
Let me just get one more call in here. Ilam is calling from Beverly. You're on the air, Ilam.
Hi. I just wanted to add another aspect to this conversation. I'm currently getting my master's in international relations at UMass Boston. And what your guest is saying is that, there are major implications for the field of international relations, and this basically what this could mean is that governments are making, calls based on patterns off of facts in terms of, dealing with the Arab Spring or other conflicts going on right now. So how does a pattern, this is dangerous because you could potentially be making decisions based on skewed facts, which political science is, you know, often sees. And then you could also be making major policy changes based on patterns or perceived patterns that your guest has explained.
Ilam, great question. Sam Arbesman, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there can certainly be a concern if you have if you're drawing conclusions based on sometimes biased data. But at the same time, though, I think it's not necessarily malicious. People are trying to use the best data they have, but oftentimes that's all they have, and you can end up with incorrect generalizations. So going back to dinosaurs, one of the reasons that when we think about dinosaurs, we think of the most well-known ones is the Tyrannosaurus Rex, the Stegosaurus, the Triceratops. One of the reasons these ones are so famous is not because they're necessarily the most important dinosaurs during the Mesozoic era when dinosaurs lived. It was because these were the dinosaurs that were easiest to find. So when the first two dig sites in the United States were developed in the late 19th and early 20th century, these dinosaur bones were everywhere. And so therefore, they entered the popular imagination. And we know a lot more about these than a lot of other dinosaurs. And I think sometimes there is a concern that the low-hanging data or informational fruit that we have can then yield lots and lots of generalizations, and so we have to always be careful of that. But I think as long as we're aware of this, and we know a lot about different biases within science, then we can overcome that and really gain a better understanding of the world around us.
Sam Arbesman is author of The Half-Life of Facts, Why Everything We Know Has an Expiration Date. Sam Arbesman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, there's a lot of you who wanted to get in on this conversation. I'm sorry I couldn't get to you all, but join us online at radioboston.org. There's more of the show in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks.